You heard Giffords refer there to weeks of failed negotiations. Just a few days ago, of course, the political system seemed completely stuck as the August 2nd deadline approached. Now the deadline has arrived. Seems likely that President Obama will sign a debt limit extension this afternoon. And we're going to talk about this with NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving very briefly. Ron, good morning.
Good to be with you,
Steve.
Does
this compromise mean the system works after all?
In a sense, it does, if this is what you consider a working system. We did drag ourselves across the finish line, so it appears the Senate's going to vote today. It came down to a weekend deal between the Senate Republican leader and Vice President Joe Biden. They have done business with each other over the years. They seem to trust each other, and they were responsible for the deal back last December. If that's the way our system works, it seems rather tenuous, and it doesn't seem like quite what the founders may have envisioned in 1789.
You're saying that it got down to one personal relationship that's worked in the past, and if it hadn't been for that, it could have been a disaster?
Well, we saw some other personal relationships that seemed to be working. President Obama was working with Speaker Boehner, and they had a not a global deal, but they had a grand bargain.
They were on their way to one, yeah.
Yes, and that would have been far better. It would have pleased the markets more, the rating agencies more. It would have probably pleased the country more and have been a much more balanced deal. But the speaker had to walk away from it because his caucus, his Republican caucus in the House, would not back him.
Now, just very briefly here, Ron, setting aside the substance of the bill, whether it's good or bad, does the manner in which it was arrived, this narrow aversion of what people felt would be disaster, caused lasting damage to the United States and to the political system?
Yes. In a sense, I think these kinds of bruises do not heal, at least not quickly. What matters now is how we address that bruise, how we address the setback. Do we go forward in the fall with a real spirit of compromise between the House and Senate and between Republicans and Democrats and try to come up with a balanced package for trying to bring down the nation's long-term deficit? If so, maybe we've learned something from this summer. Maybe that'll be to the good.
Ron, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
That's NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving speaking with us here on Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, while the Obama administration and members of Congress were struggling to come to an agreement to raise the debt ceiling, leaders of many states were keeping a close watch, too, because their credit ratings were about to be affected. Also, we will head to one of the states that was likely to be one of the most affected in the event of a default, South Carolina. That's coming up a little later in the program. But first, while all this was going on, there was big news in the world of health care for women and families. Yesterday, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services announced new guidelines that will require insurers to provide female preventive health services, including birth control, at no additional cost to patients. Joining us now to talk about all this is the Secretary for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius. Madam Secretary, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, Michelle. Great to be with you.
Obviously, we want to talk about the news that you announced yesterday, but we do need to ask you, as the leader of one of the country's largest and most visible departments in Washington, also as a former governor who had to make some tough decisions about budgets in your time as well, we'd like to ask your perspective on the deal that was announced yesterday.
Well, I don't think there's any question that it is a huge relief for the American people to have Congress finally act on what was absolutely essential to raise the debt ceiling so that we can actually pay our bills. It's like a family not paying a mortgage. We've bought the house. We need to pay the bills. I think this is a down payment, as the president said, on moving ahead with our deficit issues and controlling future spending. I don't think there's any question that it's pretty one-sided at this point, and we are still missing the concept that he has described as an essential, comprehensive element of this effort, which will be a shared sacrifice and raising revenue, particularly having the wealthiest Americans, the largest corporations in this country, contribute to getting our long-term financial house in order. And I'm hoping that this is step one and that we will have an opportunity to really look at the long-term puzzle and, you know, a comprehensive strategy in the future. But
well, speaking of step one, now under step two, this super bipartisan committee of 12 is supposed to identify spending cuts totaling $1.5 trillion. And it is said, it's being touted, you know, that Medicare and Medicaid are walled off. But is that really possible?
Well, I think it is not only possible, I think it's important. Medicare, as you know, Michelle, is part of the Affordable Care Act. A major step was taken in terms of getting the solvency of Medicare under control, and we were given a whole host of new tools to begin to align payment strategy for Medicare with what can be not only improved health outcomes, but lower costs. And that's going on in some of the best systems in the country. But prior to the passage of the Affordable Care Act, there was no real opportunity to retool the delivery system of health care. That's what we're going to accelerate moving forward. So beneficiaries will continue, unlike the Republican proposal, to end Medicare as we know it and essentially break the commitment with beneficiaries. I think the president's committed to beneficiaries continuing to have the benefits in place, but our directive is really to begin a very comprehensive overhaul of the delivery system and re-engineer the system with the financial leverage of Medicare to actually get better results, better health, better patient outcomes at a lower cost. And again, that's not theoretical. It's going on in various parts of the country. It's just never been taken to scale.
All right. Well, let's talk about the news that you announced yesterday, this decision to require that women's preventive health services be covered under new insurance plans, including birth control. Why was this important?
Well, I think it's a very historic day for women in this country because for the first time, the Affordable Care Act laid out a platform that required our department to develop a comprehensive set of prevention services that were particularly appropriate for women's health. That has never been done before. And what we were directed to do is look at what was already in place with the Preventive Services Task Force and recommendations for the Immunization Committee, recommendations that were already in place for comprehensive guidelines from HRSA, but then fill in the gaps. So we turned to the Institute of Medicine. This is a set of proposals developed by government workers or by politicians. We went to scientists and doctors to say, where are the gaps in services around women's health? And they came back with a set of proposals, which include, breastfeeding and counseling strategies, include domestic violence screening, include contraception for women, and a number of areas.
Screening for the virus that causes cervical cancer and for diabetes during pregnancy, breast pumps for nursing mothers, an annual physical, and so forth. So finally, Madam Secretary, I understand your time is limited, and we appreciate it. You're spending some of this time with us. As I understand it, the guidelines apply to new health plans beginning a year from now. How does that help all the women who are now covered by other policies where these matters are not covered or where they still have to pay copays, which in some cases are cost prohibitive?
The only copays that will be applicable, Michelle, in the future is for the so-called grandfathered plans. And those are plans that essentially met guidelines under the Affordable Care Act as of March 2010 and don't, over the course of time, shift costs to their policyholders. So it's if you have a plan that you like and the employer doesn't shift huge costs onto employees or change the benefit package, those are not applicable. But having said that, we think most plan designs will begin to adopt a lot of these recommendations, and that this was very good news for the approximately 34 million women who are now looking at the possibility of having affordable contraception, available contraception without copays and deductibles, and that's a big step forward.
Kathleen Sebelius is the Secretary for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. She was kind enough to join us on the phone from her office in Washington, D.C. Madam Secretary, we hope we'll speak again. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to visit with you.
For additional perspective, joining us now is Mary Agnes Carey, a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. That's an independent news service. Mary Agnes, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me.
Let's just start where the secretary left off. Is this, in fact, a significant announcement, as we mentioned, that this regulation applies to new plans starting in January of 2013? So is it, or rather 2012, is this really a significant expansion of services for women?
Oh, absolutely, because I think the plans had much greater variation. A lot of insurers cover some of these things. Some do, some don't. If you fit the criteria, you'll have to cover it when that plan comes up for renewal. So it's absolutely significant.
And let's talk about the debt ceiling and the effect on you know, healthcare and the healthcare sort of infrastructure. Healthcare providers are none too pleased with the debt ceiling and deficit reduction deal, and we're starting to hear from many of them. You know, given that the proponents of it say that it protects Medicaid and Medicare, and even if this bipartisan commission recommends cuts, that the cuts to Medicaid and Medicare are limited to supposedly 2%, why are they so angry?
What they're worried about is if you have across-the-board cuts, for example, let's say this panel can't report anything and these across-the-board cuts kick in. Yes, it's 2% limited in Medicare. Medicaid and Social Security and other low-income programs are off the table. But the providers, and here we're talking about like hospitals or a home health agency, they're saying, wait a minute, you cut us by 2%, you're going to hurt the beneficiary. You may say the beneficiary isn't impacted, but if you cut our revenues, and let's remember a lot of these groups came to the table voluntarily during the debates over healthcare reform and said, we will take less money in exchange for coverage, greater coverage of folks. So they're saying, wait a minute, you cut us now as part of this deal, it's going to further impact our ability to take care of patients, and that will hurt them. It could hurt, in particular, seniors' access to health care and Medicare. So that's where the rub is.
Are they saying that fewer doctors and health care providers will be actually willing to provide service if this occurs?
Well,
is that what they're saying?
They haven't gone that far. And physicians have – there's been debate about whether physicians are going to drop Medicare beneficiaries if their payments were decreased. That's another whole facet of the law that's going to – you know, the policy rather kicks in at the end of the year. But they definitely want to sound the warning to lawmakers, be careful what you do, because their feeling is it will impact the beneficiary.
Many Democrats have been adamant saying that they would not support any reductions to Medicare as part of this agreement, yet half in the House, half supported – The agreement, which is it couldn't have passed without that, without them. Why did they in the end?
I think the fear of being blamed for a default on the debt was paramount, and they were scared to death of that, number one. Number two, they can look at this protection if there's an across-the-board cut and saying, well, look, Medicare's protected by 2%, only hits the providers, Medicaid's off the table, Social Security's off the table. Now, in this,
they can argue that they're protected the most vulnerable
exactly.
people.
And that's been their argument all along. You know, the Republicans want to revolutionize Medicare and Medicaid. We don't. We're the protectors. They've run on this. That's going to be their theme all the way through 2012. And so they can – the message is consistent that
but
way.
But you're still saying – and I hate to use this metaphor – but you're still saying it's going to be a bloody battle come this fall. It's going to be a very tough fight.
It's going to be a very tough fight because this committee can look at – entitlement reform. They can look at tax increases. But we've been talking about these areas for the last 8 months on the Hill, and there's no agreement. There'll be a lot of pressure on this committee to report something because Congress hates the idea of an automatic cut, that they're not controlling the power of the purse. But so you've got that shaping up. A Medicare physician payment fix expires at the end of December. Doctors will face something like a 29% cut in Medicare if they don't fix that. You got a lot of pressure, lawmakers looking for a lot of money where there isn't a lot of money.
And there are a number of states that are still opposing the new health care law. And in fact, one state, as we understand it, is refusing to take any funds associated with it because their opposition runs that deep. So there's going to be a lot to cover. Hopefully you'll come back and see us and tell us more about this. Mary Agnes Carey is a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. That's an independent news service. It is not affiliated with the health insurance company. And she was nice enough to join us once again in our studios in Washington, D.C. Mary Agnes, thank you so much.
Thank you.
When some people go away this summer, they may have no idea that somebody dropped by their house while they were gone. Hundreds of times each year, teams from the Federal Bureau of Investigation slip into houses and office buildings. Armed with a judge's warrant, they seek information or plant bugs, and if all goes well, sneak away.
The people who do these jobs work in what's called tactical operations, or tech ops. Some of the agents describe their work to the writer Ronald Kessler, whose latest book is called The Secrets of the FBI. What is Tech Ops?
Tech Ops is a unit which breaks into homes and offices to plant bugging devices. They get into mafia hangouts. They go into embassies. They go into terrorist hangouts, and they describe themselves as court-sanctioned burglars. There are about 70 agents on about 7 different teams. And these teams spend weeks watching the target to see who goes in, to see if there are any dogs. In the case of dogs, they will show a photograph of the dog to a veterinarian who's on contract, and the veterinarian, based on the weight of the dog and the type of dog, will prescribe just the right amount of tranquilizer, and the agents will use a dart gun and shoot the tranquilizer into the dog. And then at the end of the break-in...
I thought you were going to tell me they do a psychological profile of the dog, find out if it's, you know...
I'm sure that'll be next.
Anyway, they're doing this.
At the end, they shoot the dog again with another wake-up drug because they don't want the occupants to think that, you know, something had happened to the dog and create some kind of suspicion.
You said 7 teams of about 10 on each team. That's
right.
Because it takes 10 people weeks of preparation to do a break-in.
Yeah, exactly. They each have a specialty. One will just watch to see if anybody's coming once they're in. One will take photographs of what the premises is like when they go in. If they have to move a chair, let's say, they put a tape where the chair was and then they move it back. If they have to disturb, let's say, something on a desk and there's some dust on the desk, well, they bring their own dust to replace the dust that had been moved. And they bring along a vacuum cleaner, very small, very powerful, to sweep up any sawdust. Let's say if they have to put a bug in a wall and do some drilling, they have a special algorithm to match the paint on the wall in case they have to cut through the wall. And then when it comes to watching the people who might come back, they're called key holders, people who might have keys to the premises.
Mm-hmm.
They will watch them on the night of the break-in. If any of them start to come back, they will divert them. They'll either have a police officer stop them, or they will stage a phony traffic accident, or they'll open a fire hydrant in the area so they can't come back. Anything to prevent them from coming back.
Now, I have read books about the FBI, histories of the FBI, that refer to these kinds of break-ins and call them black bag jobs, which is a far simpler phrase than the kind of elaborate operations that you're talking about. How have these units evolved over time?
Black bag jobs were generally thought of as being illegal break-ins. And back then, you know, there weren't any laws that really existed, and where there were, J. Edgar Hoover would just disregard them. But the FBI has been doing this historically. In fact, I have one anecdote about the FBI breaking into an embassy in Washington. And under Hoover, they had this sort of ruse whereby they didn't want to recommend a break-in that might be a big flap and cause all kinds of problems. So what they did was they would break in first, and then they would write a memo saying, asking for permission and saying, security guaranteed. And that was a code phrase that would tell the higher-ups, it's okay, we've already done it. And then they would forward that to Hoover, and Hoover would approve it.
Oh, man.
And in this one case, it turned out that one of the agents who was doing the bugging had a heart attack and died in the ambassador's office. And as a result, his bowels emptied, and unfortunately. And so what did the agents do? They took the Oriental rug that was just soiled to Bergman's Cleaners, which was an all-night cleaner, and had it cleaned. But it was still wet, so they put it down on the floor, and then they painted above on the ceiling to make it look like there had been some kind of water leak.
So they've been creative for a while.
Yeah, but now, I mean, it's so amazing. One thing they do is they create a phony front to a house or a townhouse to cover up what they're doing, picking the locks. They will take a photo, for example, of a townhouse in Baltimore. This actually happened, and replicate it on a huge tarp as large as the front of the house, and put it in front of the house. They go behind the tarp. They pick the locks. This would be at night, so that passersby don't notice that anybody's there.
So it just gets unrolled from the roof or something like
that? Yeah, they sort of unfurl it like an umbrella sort of thing. And the same with a phony bush. They created a phony bush, and behind the bush, the agents would go zip, zip, zip to the door in order to pick the locks. They'd be hiding behind the bush. The bush would be moving along. You know, it would be very funny on a home video TV show.
Is this job a career choice or an assignment, by which I mean, do you do this for 30 years or is it something you do for a couple of years as you rotate through different jobs at the Bureau?
The people who might be good prospects are approached by agents on Tech Ops and asked, you know, do you mind being away from home a lot, leading questions like that. And
how do you feel about lying, wearing disguises, questions like that, basically?
That's right. And then it's up to the agent if he wants to be on these teams, because it is so dangerous.
But then how long are they? Is it something you will do for the rest of your
career?
Some
of them do stay on the teams for their whole careers. You know, I interviewed one who's been on there, who's done some 5,000 break-ins. In some other cases, though, you know, the stress is too much, the travel is too much. Some of them are on the road, you know, 90% of the year.
I feel like you may be telling me a large slice of what the FBI's job has been for the past decade since 9/11, because from the outside, it seems that so much of the job of law enforcement and intelligence agencies has just been monitoring people, waiting, watching. Occasionally, you hear of an arrest, and you presume that they've been watching that person for years.
Yeah, when you think of what it takes to stop a possible terrorist, you do have to conduct this kind of surveillance. Just one terrorist can wreak havoc. And so they will spend weeks doing the surveillance beforehand. They'll, in some cases, do bugging for years in order to really catch this person.
Ronald Kessler is the author of The Secrets of the FBI. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
We turn now to the growing power of supercomputers. Supercomputers are crucial for analyzing complex problems like climate change and particle physics. But as they grow, so does their appetite for electricity. Reporter Lauren Sommer of member station KQED looks at efforts to make supercomputing more energy efficient.
Meet the Cray 1.
If you needed an icon for a supercomputer, you would use the Cray 1.
This 6-foot-tall tower of wires was the most powerful supercomputer the world had ever seen in 1976. Today, it's part of the Computer History Museum in Silicon Valley, where Dag Spicer is a senior curator.
It blew people's minds. It was so powerful, so fast.
Of course, in today's terms,
it's roughly equivalent to a first-generation iPhone from Apple.
The reason we don't play Angry Birds on a supercomputer today is thanks to something called Moore's Law.
Moore's Law is a prediction made by Intel co-founder Gordon Moore in 1965 that the number of transistors incorporated in a chip will double approximately every 12 months.
What that means is computer chips have gotten smaller and faster at an incredible rate over the last 5 decades, which leads us to...
This is our new Cray XE6 supercomputing system.
Also known as Hopper, the nickname that's used by computer scientist John Shelf and his colleagues at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. And right now, it's chewing on some complicated problems.
Particle accelerator design, we have fusion energy, and then we also have a laser plasma inertial fusion simulation.
Okay, some very complicated problems. It's as powerful as 10,000 desktop computers. But in just a few years, Berkeley Lab will get a new model that's as powerful as 100,000 desktops. According to Moore's Law, that next generation supercomputer should be smaller. But
the problem is that now we can't make them go any faster.
Shelf says computer chips have hit a wall.
So we can cram more things in the chip, but if you make them go fast, it's so hot they'll melt.
If chips themselves aren't faster, supercomputers will simply have to add more and more of them to increase computing power, which means much more energy use. Hopper uses around 3 megawatts of electricity, about as much as 2,000 homes.
Projections say that at the end of the decade, we'd be at 100 megawatts if we continue.
That's enough power for a small city. The electricity bill alone would be roughly $100 million a year.
What that says is that our current approach to doing supercomputing is a dead end, and that we need to think of dramatically new ways to improve the efficiency of computing.
Shelf says that could be done with some very familiar technology.
Hello?
Cell phones have computer chips that are designed to be energy efficient, so your phone lasts longer on a charge. Shelf says, why not build a supercomputer with chips that combine millions of these small cell phone processors?
In using that approach, we're able to demonstrate an additional 80 times more energy efficiency than business as usual.
which would mean a much more practical supercomputer. Whether or not it gets built depends on companies like Intel, who would design the chips. Schauf says Berkeley Lab hopes to use this cell phone-inspired computer to model some of the trickier effects of climate change, like rainfall patterns, ice sheet melt, and the effects of clouds.
It enables policymakers to have the tools they need to make important decisions that have trillion-dollar consequences.
That way, Schauf says, supercomputers could work on tomorrow's climate and energy challenges without contributing to the very problem they're trying to solve. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Sommer in San Francisco.